Queen Elizabeth I was the daughter of a brutal psychopath who was probably syphilitic as well, known to history as King Henry VIII. When Elizabeth was just 2 years old, her father gave the order to kill her mother, Anne Boleyn, and she was beheaded with a sword. Despite all this, Elizabeth grew up adoring her father. She became a student of languages. By the age of 12, she was an expert translator of Latin, French, and Italian. So Elizabeth created a handwritten book as a gift for her father. And the book's a kind of masterpiece. Hundreds of pages of perfect, beautiful, italic handwriting. Her handwriting. No mistakes, no blots, no mistranslations. She was 12. One historian thinks that this is a sign of a child genius. Elizabeth came to power at a very dangerous time when England was just a minor player in world affairs, but by the end of her 45 years on the throne, England was a major European power. Elizabeth fell in love several times, probably, but she never married, and she said it would be better to be a beggar woman and single than to be a married queen. Elizabeth I is Jane Currow's hero. Jane's a commentator and a writer. She worked in advertising for years. Elizabeth has worked her way so far into Jane's imagination that she's written two novels, written from Elizabeth's point of view. The first was called Just a Girl, and now she's followed that up with Just a Queen. Hello, Jane. Welcome back.
Thank you, Richard. Lovely to be here.
To be honest, Elizabeth is one of my heroes as well, for different reasons to you, I think, actually.
Okay,
and I think
good.
That's the sign of how multifaceted she is. How far back does your interest in her go?
It goes so far back, I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in her. So I don't remember when I developed the interest. I suspect it was because I had in my bedroom when I was, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, that sort of age, there was an old wardrobe. I think it must have been my grandfather's. It was called a gentleman's wardrobe, and it had weird little, you know, drawers and little pockets of things. And in there was a bunch of encyclopedias, I think probably printed about 1910. They were probably also my grandfather's when he was a boy. And I used to read them at night. And I used to skip all the science stuff and all of that. But I loved the story. So I loved myths and legends, but also the stories of kings and queens. And I think that's probably where I first developed my passion for Elizabeth I, reading about her life and just suddenly going, oh, a woman who did it on her own. Thank goodness I found one.
There weren't that many examples for you to latch onto, were they? There's Elizabeth and not much else beside.
No, there were saintly women,
yeah.
You know, rescued sailors at sea and that sort of thing. And there was a lot of self-sacrifice in the women that were held up as examples. And I was never into self-sacrifice, never. Whereas Elizabeth, it wasn't about self-sacrifice, really. It was about the wielding of power. There were virtually no examples of women who wielded power and also were seen as wielding power successfully. Any other women who were seen as wielding power were often seen as the heinous, you know, devil woman who had destroyed the man, you know, that kind of thing. They were sort of blamed. But Elizabeth somehow, perhaps because she was no one's wife, was seen as wielding power and wielding it successfully. And that just absolutely gave me hope.
So she really stands out. And do you think it's that decision not to marry, to be the Virgin Queen, that allows her to do that, or what?
Well, I think the way we regard that decision is, yes, it allows us to sort of remove her from needing to be a servant to either husband and children. By not getting involved in family life, we make it okay, sort of acceptable, for a woman to wield power on her own. It seems to be very, very difficult still for us to accept that a woman can have what we call it all when we talk about women, which is an interesting and perhaps powerful career and family. Of course, those are the sorts of things that men just expect out of life, but for women it's called having it all. She had to make a sacrifice, yes. She had to stay unmarried, though at the time I doubt it was any kind of a sacrifice. I think it was a choice a lot of women would have made if they'd been able to.
Let's start right at the beginning with her life. She's born as the daughter of King Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, both extraordinary people in very different ways. Henry VIII, the more I read about him, the more he strikes me as kind of like a really thoroughly nasty piece of work, like a kind of a Stalin of the Tudor era in a way, a thug, totalitarian in instinct, a bully and murderous in his instincts as well. Do you see him that way, Jane?
I think he became that. He started so well. This is often talked about. You know, he was the very bonny prince. He was considered to be very handsome, very charming and very bright. He wrote music. He composed poetry. He wrote a very learned document which earned the English royal family the title of Defender of the Faith, which the Queen still has in reply to Martin Luther. So he was a very, you know, erudite guy when he was young. But the older he got and the more frustrated he got with this fear of never having a son, the more this seemed to warp his character. Because you have to remember, Henry VIII was the son of a usurper. Henry VII tossed Richard III off the throne, took the throne in battle, and then had to sort of shore up his rule. So Henry VIII was desperate to have a son, not just because he was a pathological sexist, although he was definitely that, but because, for very sensible political reasons, he needed to have that security for what was a very shaky dynasty.
So he had his first marriage to Catherine of Aragon. That didn't result in a son, so she got the flick. Then he settles into marriage with Anne Boleyn. How did they get on? She was quite outspoken, wasn't she? So how did they get on in the marriage? Do we know?
Well, prior to the marriage, they got on awfully well. She held him at bay for many, many years, I think 7 or 8 years, saying she wouldn't sleep with him because she wasn't a whore and she wouldn't sleep with a man she wasn't married to. And in the end, that meant that he married her so he could sleep with her. She must have been fascinating. And after the marriage, however, and after she had Elizabeth, the girl, the whole thing started to go south. And I think people react badly to stress and fear. And I think as Anne became more and more frantic about having a son, he became more and more frantic about having a son and more worrying that he thought he committed a sin the first time marrying his brother's wife. That's why he didn't get a son. Now he committed sin again by marrying her. The tension became unbearable and all reports seem to indicate that she became shrill. She became kind of clingy and needy. Never the most attractive thing.
So you're saying then that the birth of a daughter rather than a son, both parents might have seen that as a sign of God's disfavour, God passing bad judgment on them because he got remarried.
At that time, I think that people put down an almost everything that happened to God's will, and then they would look for where the sin had been, performed so that they would be so cursed. And it was almost always the woman's fault, of course, whatever happened, that there was a curse falling upon them.
So she didn't deliver him a son, but a daughter instead. So why did he decide to kill her? Why did Henry VIII decide to kill Anne Boleyn rather than just dump her and move on to the next wife?
Because he'd annulled the marriage with Catherine of Aragon. And he'd done that because she was the daughter of the King and Queen of Spain. She was the niece, I think, or the aunt of the Emperor, of the Holy Roman Emperor. She had very powerful friends. Anne Boleyn had no powerful friends. She was the daughter of a minor nobleman. She had no one to protect her. It was cleaner to get rid of her. How was he going to divorce her? He couldn't have two wives hanging around. And the funny thing is, Catherine of Aragon died, I think, only a few weeks before Anne Boleyn was killed. So in a way, her death wiped Henry's slate clean. The next marriage couldn't be seen as a sin because both his previous wives were dead.
What do we know about the way she met her execution?
Oh, well, it happened very quickly. She was suddenly kind of arrested in the palace and raced off to the Tower. Her friends and even her brother were also arrested with her, a musician, some friends and her brother, all accused of adultery with her. None of it at all likely or possible. She was in the Tower for not particularly long. Henry decided, and the myth is, he decided to have her beheaded by a French swordsman as an act of mercy. It's hard to think of it being merciful, really, isn't it? But nevertheless, and when she was told that she was to die the next morning and that a sword was to be used, she laughed. She was a quite extraordinary woman, and she put her hands around her neck and said, "It's such a little neck." She seemed to accept her fate, and when she spoke on the scaffold just before she was beheaded, she said not a word against Henry. She was resigned to her fate and spoke well of him, and that she had always loved him and always would love him, and that he was a great and good king of England. Perhaps she had her daughter's future in mind when she spoke those words. Perhaps she really believed it. They seemed to take death much more in their stride in that time than we can imagine doing. I suppose it was around them all the time. I can't imagine how they managed to steal their courage and put their head on the block, frankly, but they all did.
So little Elizabeth, she's two or three when this happens, and she grows up in this as Lady Elizabeth now. She gets knocked back in the line of succession, and she's known as the king's second bastard daughter after a while, rather than Princess Elizabeth, which is how she was born. Did she grow up with a sense of danger then, a sense that her life might be endangered as well? Was it a dangerous childhood that she grew up into?
I think when she was a child and her father was alive, no. I don't think she was actively in danger or felt in danger. She was neglected. She wasn't clothed properly. She very rarely saw her father. Certainly, it was not for neither her nor Mary, was it a good childhood. Their brother was all and everything, Edward, the third wife's son. They were shunted to a side and regarded as embarrassments, really, because they were constant reminders of Henry's failed marriages. So no, but I think once Henry died, and then her brother, of course, who only reigned for 6 years, then life got very, very dangerous for Elizabeth.
She composed that book that I was talking about right at the start there, that book of prose, which was a gift to her father, which is, like I say, it's perfect. I've seen footage of this, the pages being turned. It's incredibly beautiful, exquisite, and utterly perfect. Not a thing wrong with it. She did it at 12 and did all the translations herself, which David Starkey, the historian, says is the work of a child prodigy, like a Mozart. He compares her to Mozart. Now, this is the thing. If she is a kind of genius, if she does have a genius sort of intellect and ability like that, geniuses don't make good rulers, though, Jane. Really. They make terrible rulers. It's better to have a first-rate temperament than a first-rate mind. What do you think of that?
Yes, but in this case, what you've got is an outsider who's a genius. Most geniuses, very rare for women to be called a genius. There's very few of them, if you think about it, that have ever had that epithet or adjective used for them. Elizabeth very rarely gets it even so. I'm glad David Starkey uses it. But I think if you're an outsider, and by being a female, she was just by definition an outsider, that tempers the genius. If you like, that creates the temperament that can work with the genius. Most geniuses are coddled, idolised, you know, pampered, encouraged, all that kind of thing. They're made to think they're a genius. I think the worst thing you could do for a genius is to tell them they're a genius. Well, nobody ever told Elizabeth that. They knew she was smart. They knew she was smart. And Henry appears to have had a fondness for her. He had a pet name for her, Madame Isabeau. And, you know, whenever she saw him, I think it was, you know, unbelievable for her. And she really relished that attention. Hence the perfection of that book. You can see the 12-year-old girl labouring over showing her father what it was she had to offer, just how much there was in this child of his that he could appreciate. The tragedy, of course, was that he couldn't really see it fully because she was the wrong gender.
After her father died, she moved in with Henry's widow, Catherine Parr, and her new husband, Thomas Seymour. Now, Thomas Seymour's 40. She's 14. What kind of is hijinks the word I'm looking for here? What happened in this house? What do the reports say about this time?
Very strange goings on. He would come into her bedroom unexpectedly and tickle her her night clothes.
Oh, yeah.
To the horror of her governess, Cat Ashley, who was very worried about it, and her tutor. But Catherine Parr seems to have encouraged these supposedly childish games.
Yes.
They didn't strike me or anyone else really as particularly childish at the time, remembering that a 14-year-old girl was often married and had children at that period of history. There's also a very bizarre incident where Elizabeth is sewing under a tree, I think, and Thomas Seymour Moore comes across her and he grabs her scissors that she's been using for the stitching and he begins to cut up her dress while she's wearing it. And Catherine Parr arrives, Thomas Seymour's wife, and holds Elizabeth's arms pinioned so that he can better cut her dress to ribbons with the scissors. This is all very weird sexual play.
Was he trying to marry her? Was this a bid for him to marry the princess who was now an heir to the throne at this point? What do you think was going on there?
Well, he was unfortunately already married to Catherine Parr, but I think she was probably a very attractive young woman, so I think there was probably genuine sexual feelings there. But I think he also had his eye on the main chance. Catherine Parr was pregnant. Women died in childbirth like flies at that time. He may well have thought, well, there's a very good chance my wife could die. She was quite old to be having her first child. In fact, she did die as a result of the childbirth, but by then it was too late for Thomas Seymour. So, yes, he may well have had his eye on the future, but I think he genuinely enjoyed it, and he probably genuinely enjoyed playing this kind of power game with the daughter of a king.
Eventually, Thomas Seymour was arrested on suspicion of plotting to marry Elizabeth and to overthrow Elizabeth's brother. And do you think, what lessons do you think she learned from that episode? Do you think she learned that you can't trust men who seem to be attracted to you because they may want to see her as a pathway to national power?
I think, yes, she certainly was aware of that. But I think she learned something much more fundamental. I think she learned she couldn't let her guard down. I think she learned that her reputation, because the rumour went around England that she was pregnant to him, and that horrified her because she was very, very well aware of how important a woman's reputation was. And so she immediately changed the way she dressed and put on dark clothes and, you know, was very subdued and carried a prayer book at all times. She was trying to rebuild this image of the good, the pure, the virginal Elizabeth to counteract the rumours that she was absolutely horrified by.
When her brother died, that meant her older sister Mary then took the throne, who became known as Bloody Mary, and she began the tried to shift England back to being a Catholic nation. And so the persecution of Protestants began and rolled out, and it was a really ugly time. How close did Elizabeth get to getting killed in this period?
Oh, very close. Very close. She was taken to the Tower. Mary had a very ambivalent relationship with Elizabeth, as you could imagine. They were princesses together, or the Lady Mary and the Lady Elizabeth, when they were both the royal bastards together. They clung to each other. I think they got on quite well. I think they were fond of each other when they were children. They didn't have a lot to do with one another while Edward was on the throne. So Mary was ambivalent. This was her only real living relative. And Elizabeth, I think, was a very charming person. I think everything you read about Elizabeth was that she was charismatic. She drew people to her. So this both infuriated Mary and attracted her. So it never seems that Mary wanted to kill Elizabeth, though sometimes she really wanted to kill her. She was in two minds. The thing that saved Elizabeth was Philip of Spain, who married Mary Tudor and who realised pretty quickly that Mary probably wasn't long for this world. She was quite old. She was 38 when she took the throne. She was very sickly. She was very unhappy. She was very neurotic. She's one of the saddest characters in history, I think. And I think he had his eye on the main chance, and he and Elizabeth spent a lot of time together when Mary had her weird phantom pregnancy.
She had a phantom pregnancy?
Mary Tudor had a phantom pregnancy where she believed that she was pregnant. All the signs were there. She withdrew. They went into confinement some months before they were due to give birth. And the time ticked on and the time ticked on and the time ticked on. And the whole of the country was in a kind of completely frozen because no one could do anything. They didn't know if the Queen was going to survive childbirth. Was the child going to be a son? Nothing happened for months and months and months. And Elizabeth and Philip were together at the court. And they got to know each other well. And Philip, it seems, protected Elizabeth, partly because he probably liked her and partly because he thought, well, Mary's probably going to cark it, and the phantom pregnancy probably was some sort of abdominal tumour, and maybe I could marry Elizabeth after that and keep my hold on England. And indeed, he did propose when Mary had died and Elizabeth was queen.
So Elizabeth became queen at 25 years old. And at that stage, Jane, I mean, just if you sort of put this in context, her father's murdered her mother.
Mm-hmm.
Her stepsister has imprisoned her in the Tower of London and brought her close to the point of execution. She's possibly been sexually abused, although I don't know how much of a 21st century term that is to fling on the Elizabethan era, but sexually abused by the person who's her stepfather. It's a wonder she wasn't a monster.
Yeah, it is quite extraordinary that she wasn't a monster, but she wasn't. She, in fact, seemed to take her appalling upbringing and use it to make her compassionate for her time and intensely civilised and self-aware. It seems that, and perhaps, I'm just thinking about this now, perhaps this is why she's my hero. She's one of the few women in history who appears to have applied her intelligence to her life, used her brain to think not just about her public, you know, execution of being a queen, but her own personality, her own life and desires. She was able to be ruled by her head and make decisions which were hard, really hard to make, about love and all those kinds of things, and sometimes indeed about executing Mary Queen of Scots, for example. But if they needed to be made, she could make them because her head told her what she should do. And that, I think, is the thing that I admire most about her, that applying intelligence to her life.
The coronation was reported to be a joyful thing because she was popular.
Very.
And a lot of cheering crowds and, you know, hallelujahs and the like. But you see, this is a lonely time for her. Why?
She's the last of her family. She has no peers left. Anne of Cleves, who, interestingly enough, she was very, very close to. All the children were very close to both Anne of Cleves and Catherine Parr. And Anne of Cleves, of course, gave her a model of how to have a single life, because Anne of Cleves and Henry VIII negotiated when they both decided they didn't want to be married to one another. And she got a house and she got an allowance and she got to live a very nice life, thank you very much, under the auspices of the English king without any of the sacrifices needed to be married to him. And I think Anne of Cleves was important to Elizabeth. She was at Mary's coronation and Elizabeth and Anne sat together at that coronation. Anne of Cleves had died just before Elizabeth came to the throne. So there was no one there. May have been some Carey relatives from her mother's side, but there was no one there who was related to her. And she was taking on this job entirely on her own. She had some very, very good attendants. She was incredibly loyal to people who were with her. Cat Ashley was with her basically, practically from birth. And William Cecil was with her from her very early 20s. And Robert Dudley, of course, was with her his whole life. She was probably the man she loved, but they'd known each other as children. They were all there, and they were probably the closest people to her. But there's no getting away from it. She was their master. They were her servants. So there was no one. She had no peers.
She was under a lot of pressure right from the get-go to marry another foreign monarch, a lot of pressure to do this, because quite rightly people are worried about the succession and the stability of the realm and all of that, and if there's a clear line of succession, then that's all well and good. So why? Why do you think were the reasons why she said no every time to marrying a foreign monarch?
Well, I think they're fairly obvious when you think about them. The first and most obvious is her father cut her mother's head off. That'd put you off the whole thing, I reckon, if you had a choice. She had a choice. Most women had no choice. They were married off very early. That was their role. She knew that people died like flies in childbirth and in agony. I mean, terrifying. Sex for women at that time, I don't know how many of them brought themselves to do it. I suppose they had no choice. That's why. Because the kinds of deaths they could experience were just beyond belief. Also, and I think this is not less important than the other reasons. Had she married a foreign monarch, they would have taken the power from her. What was in it for her to marry someone else? He would be the king now and people would pay attention to him. He would get her pregnant if that would happen. She might die in agony. Or even if she didn't, she'd be childbirthing constantly as a result. Wacko the diddlo. She had a choice.
Knocked up and living in a cold water flat, as the old saying goes.
Absolutely. She took one look at that as a possibility and went, and otherwise, I could have all the power, not have to defer to a man. I could run the country. I could let my intelligence, you know, really reach its full potential, and I won't risk dying a horrible death in childbirth. And I don't really fancy blokes all that much anyway, because look what one of them did to my mum. I think I won't.
And yet, we say all this, but it would be a big mistake to see her as a passionless woman, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think it was easy for her to make that decision.
She liked the fellas.
She loved the chase. My reading of the history around this is that Elizabeth particularly liked flirting with unavailable men. That's what she loved.
She's that girl.
She's a tease. She loves that because there's no danger in it. She can get the admiration. She can get the thrill. She can get all of that fun without any of the responsibility. There's a lovely episode in her life where the Duke of Anjou, who was her last possible marriage, sent his man, Simeo, to woo her in advance. And she loved him much more than she actually loved the Duke of Anjou.
You were speaking there about the Duke of Anjou, who was probably one of the two men she loved most. The first one, though, was Robert Dudley. What kind of a man was Robert Dudley that should turn her head like that?
Well, I think he had a number of things. I mean, he was very handsome. He was very charismatic. He was a doer, you know, a man of action, all that kind of thing. He was her master of horse, which basically meant he was her events organiser. But he also looked extremely good on a horse, and they'd go hunting together. And she loved hunting, and it was an escape, and he was her playfellow. I think William Cecil was her taskmaster and her serious companion for the business of governing, and Robert Dudley was the person with whom she could be herself and let her hair down.
And yet she's saying at the same time, she says she's married to the people of England, and she wanted her epitaph, she said, to read, "Here lies Elizabeth, which reigned a virgin and died a virgin." Yes, she's flirting with a bloke here. She's a complex figure, Jane.
Incredibly complex. But with Robert Dudley in particular, I think there was a time when she did think she might just be able to marry him, that she played or even flirted with that idea. When his wife, Amy Dudley...
Oh, he was married when they were flirting?
Yes. Amy Robsart was his wife's name, Amy Dudley, after they married. And she developed a tumour in the breast. And she knew, Elizabeth knew this, Robert Dudley knew this. And then, unfortunately, she died in very mysterious circumstances. It's still one of the great mysteries of history. She ordered all the servants to go to a fair. Then she was found at the bottom of the stairs with a broken neck. Nobody knows if she jumped or if she was pushed. But what this meant was Elizabeth could not marry Robert Dudley.
Was Robert Dudley suspected of having killed her so he could marry the Queen?
That was the suspicion. He was tried and found innocent. Who knows? The possibility is that she killed herself, perhaps because of the pain of the breast tumour. Who knows? If Robert Dudley had killed her so he could marry the Queen, he was a fool, because that suspicion meant he could never marry the Queen. And if she was going to die of the tumour in her breast, then all he had to do was wait, and they would have had a much better chance. That basically removed that possibility for all time. My conceit about Elizabeth is that she came to think that this was probably a good thing.
The other great affair she had, if that can be called an affair, the kind of chaste affair she had, was with the Duke of Anjou that you mentioned before, a French nobleman. How close did she get to contemplating marrying him?
He was her last chance. She was about 47 at the time. He was the youngest son of the King of France. He was 5'1". He was much shorter than she was. He was 25 years younger than she was. But he was witty. He was charming. And he understood reality. He had that French phlegmatic approach to the world, which I think she appreciated. I don't think she really wanted to marry him. I think she just had to face up to the fact that if she didn't marry him, she really wasn't going to marry anybody. And even though you may have made that decision and said to everybody, "I don't want to get married," which she did, the reality of "you will never get married" brings you up short and makes you think, am I doing the right or the wrong thing? And I think that is what happened around the Duke of Anjou.
This was a time of persecution and counter-persecution. Uh-huh. Protestants against Catholics, Catholics against Protestants, back and forward. And without getting bogged down in the rights and wrongs of any of that, the thing, this is what appeals to me most about her, is her refusal, as far as she could, to punish people on matters of conscience. And she said famously, and this is the thing that I think ought to be better known about her, she said she refused to make a window into men's souls. There is only one Jesus Christ, she said, and all the rest is a dispute over trifles. I think with that statement, you may see the birth of something like classic English moderation and tolerance. Now, that's something the English failed at. We know all that. And it certainly didn't work in Ireland. We know all that. But nonetheless, as an ideal, I think we start to see there, she won't persecute people for their consciences. She doesn't want to look into the window of their souls. What
no,
do you think of
that? Oh, I think that's absolutely right. It was one of the things that absolutely attracted me to her. She was just so smart. It's such a smart thought. Who cares what people think in their hearts? Why should that be my business? All I care is that they obey the law. If you obey the law, I'll leave you alone. And that was always her attitude. There were plenty of Catholics in her court. She knew who they were. As long as they obeyed the law, which involved they had to go to Protestant services and things, but they could have their own, you know, she just wasn't interested, didn't want to know. But this, you know, she was not a fanatic. There was not a fanatical bone in her body. She was a pragmatist, and she wanted what was best. She could do terrible things to get there if she needed to, but she did them very rarely. I love the fact that when she was really pushed into having to execute the Duke of Norfolk, almost all the Duke of Norfolks were executed. They were constantly getting into trouble. When they went, they looked at the scaffold. It was 13 years after she came to the throne. They had to rebuild it because it hadn't been used, and so it rotted. They had to build a new one to behead this man. Now, that made her a complete anomaly at her time, but she didn't go around chopping people's heads off unless she absolutely was pushed into a corner. And even then, she had three sleepless nights with Dudley and Cecil sitting next to her trying to make her sign the death warrant.
It's just smart, too, at another level, because she didn't create martyrs that would then lead rebellions. That was the thing. There were rebellions, but they weren't led by martyrs. They weren't conducted in the name of a martyr. This was the thing. People think that you can contribute. She actually saved England from the kind of religious wars that were afflicting the rest of the continent, in France in particular.
She didn't feed that beast by creating people who they could stand up and say, look how cruel she is. Of course. She did execute Mary Queen of Scots, and then she did create a martyr.
I'm going to play a little thing here from my favourite screen version of Elizabeth, which is Glenda Jackson from the 1970s, not your Cate Blanchett.
That's right.
Not your Betty Davis. It's all just romance, that is. But I'm going to get in trouble for that. But but it's the Glenda Jackson one that I like the most. And here she is with her ministers, and one of her ministers is laid up sick in bed.
Rest you still, old man. God's death, Burley, I command you, rest you still. They did not tell me you were sick until this morning.
Gout, madam, gout. I suffer more from your displeasure.
And so you should, you're a wicked wretch.
As your majesty
false
pleases.
False dissembler.
Nay, madam, not
old
that.
Old and doting.
Jesus,
and a traitor.
Wrong. Madam, I protest.
How is it with you, Walsingham? Does the stone still plague you?
Aye, madam.
You swallow too much bad physic and hang too many good physicians. God's death, Walsingham. I am almost your age, yet I can dance six galliards of a morning and enjoy a healthful sweat.
Your Majesty's continuing good health is a joy to her people.
But mark me, both of you. I have not forgotten you contrived the death of that woman.
Like, it'd be great if all of us could dance six galliards of a morning and enjoy a healthful sweat like that. She's clearly an insufferable human being. I mean, she's quite insufferable there.
Yeah.
But enormously entertaining and charming. There's a charm that's underlying
that
as
well. She's
playing
with them, isn't she? You're a wicked wretch. You
yes.
know she means, I love you dearly and I'm missing you and I want you to come back to work for me.
Apparently Margaret Thatcher used to knock her ministers around like that as well. She'd just run rings around them like that and have them going, yes, no, no, what, no, yes, all right, yes, whatever.
I'm liking Margaret Thatcher better as you speak.
Nonetheless, there's that line at the end there. She's talking there about the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, who in the end became a rival to her for her throne. How different were they as human beings, Jane? Do you think?
I think they were extraordinarily different. They were very, very curious about one another because they were their only peers. But Elizabeth was a neglected and, I think you can argue, abused child. Mary was the pampered darling of the French court. She went there when she was an infant. She was destined to marry the Dauphin, which she eventually did. And she didn't have a moment's difficulty in her early life. The difference between the two of them couldn't be more marked in terms of how they were brought up. But it seems that being neglected, an outsider, at risk, dismissed, belittled, unimportant, is actually a much better start if you want to rule a kingdom wisely than to be pampered, indulged, and made a fuss of.
That is just like one of the truest principles of history, I think. Born to the purple makes you a terrible king, queen, emperor. It just happens that way. So that's the big difference there. Mary's pampered in a way that Elizabeth certainly isn't. Was she a serious threat to Elizabeth at any stage? Was she a serious threat to take the throne?
Oh, absolutely. The whole of Catholic Europe wanted Elizabeth dead, and Mary was her only heir until Mary had her son. And then James, the 6th of Scotland, or 1st of England as he eventually became the obvious heir. But the heir is always a threat to the monarch. That's why Elizabeth was under threat when Mary was on the throne. She was the heir. So heirs are always problematic. But Catholic Europe and the Pope, of course, put a fatwa on Elizabeth, actually said to people, if you kill the Queen of England, not only will it not be a sin, but you will go directly to heaven. You will be among God's chosen people.
Well, the Pope said that, did he?
Yeah, basically, something along those lines. So that was a papal bull issued to that effect. So that then put her at enormous risk from fanatical Catholics, who then weren't seen as risking their own lives. They were going to go straight to heaven. Slightly like ISIS, perhaps. Anyway, so that was when that happened, that made everything much more difficult for Mary, Queen of Scots, because that then really put Elizabeth at risk of assassination. And that was the worry. And, of course, we are right in the middle of the English Reformation. So all her ministers know that if Mary, Queen of Scots, became Queen of England, they would all be for the chop. Possibly literally. So there's a huge pressure on keeping Elizabeth alive. She nearly died of smallpox quite early on in her reign. The terror as to who would inherit the throne, and it was all about religion. It was all about, we want a Protestant heir, not a Catholic heir. So the fact that Mary was a Catholic meant that Elizabeth and Mary were on basically a collision course from the days they were born.
In the end, though, Elizabeth kept her locked up, effectively, for 19 years until she was tricked into joining a rebellion, joining a rebellion. Really, Mary had no alternative to do it. I mean, she was like an insect in a bottle, really, all those years. And Elizabeth, you know, Mary was executed, and Elizabeth there, you can hear in that audio, railing against her ministers for making her do this. That's bad faith on Elizabeth. She put herself in that situation where that was the only possible outcome. Elizabeth, you know, moaned and complained and harangued her ministers about it, but she has to wear that, doesn't she?
Yes, of course she has to wear a great deal of the responsibility. But I think, oddly enough, Mary does too. Mary behaved as Queen of Scotland in a way that her people threw her off the throne. They called her a whore. They wanted to burn her. Her husband, Henry Darnley, the father of James I, was murdered in the most strange fashion. Whether she was complicit with that or not, history doesn't know. It's another great mystery. But her people had had enough. They regarded Mary as a bad ruler. So she lost the throne of Scotland. Once she lost the throne of Scotland and fled across the border to England, what on earth was Elizabeth to do with her? Had Mary been a wiser ruler and stayed, you know, actually hang on to her throne, I think history would have been very different and Mary may indeed have died in her own bed. But unfortunately, she was not very good at the business of ruling because she saw it as her right and that she could behave any way she wanted to. She was the queen, therefore no one could say different. But unfortunately, it wasn't true. The Scots loathed her. They threw her out. Elizabeth didn't invade and kidnap her. Mary got thrown out, fled across the border, and Elizabeth was stuck with this, what did she call her? Daughter of debate.
In the end, of course, she suffered terrible guilt, or seemed to suffer guilt. Do you think that's authentic?
Oh, yes, absolutely authentic. She had a four-day walking nervous breakdown after she was told that Mary had been executed, because even though she signed the death warrant, she refused to give the order for it to be carried out. And the reason she blames Walsingham and Cecil in that excerpt is because they just said to themselves, on the principle of it is easier to ask for forgiveness than permission, they said, we've got a signed death warrant, let's not ask her again, let's just bloody well go and do it. So they bloody well went and did it. They came back and they said, madam, we've done it. And at first she was so shocked, she just kind of went numb. But the next morning she clapped her secretary Davison, who brought her the news, into the tower. She banished Cecil. She locked herself in her apartments and she had basically a collapse.
The execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, was just one of the factors that provoked the Spanish into wanting to send an invasion armada. That and the English meddling in the Netherlands as well. Complicated thing. Anyway, the Spanish send this huge armada of ships up to England to invade. And that's when Elizabeth appears. Well, she's wearing a kind of a breastplate or something, mm-hmm. an armoured breastplate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In front of her own troops. And she says this: I am come amongst you, as you see, at this time, not for my recreation and disport, but being resolved in the midst and heat of the battle to live and die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and my people, my honour and my blood, even in the dust. And then she says, I know I have the body of a weak, feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too. Wow. That's Churchill gets his rhetoric from there, doesn't he?
I reckon.
All that hard Anglo-Saxon language, this fight, die, dust, death, blood, all this language. That's the kind of thing you want to hear a monarch say when you're about to go and fight and die, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. She said that at Tilbury, and absolutely. It's one of the great stirring speeches of English politics, because, of course, it's not of English literature, though it sounds Shakespearean. It sounds as if it could be from, you know, Henry IV, Part One or whatever, but it's not. It's Elizabeth speaking to her troops from her guts.
Yeah, it's earthy.
That's what's so good.
There's the heart and stomach of a king. Not the heart and soul, but the heart and stomach of a king. And there's dust and dirt and all those things there. So she could be quite earthy, I suppose, when she needed to be.
Oh, very earthy, I think.
Does this make her the first proper English warrior queen since Boadicea or Boadicea, I wonder?
Well, there were others. I think there was Matilda and there was Isabel and people like that who also led armies, but they were despised for it. She was venerated for it, partly because she won. And none of those soldiers on that day actually lost their lives, because, in fact, it was a sea battle, and there were a couple of things working in England's favour. The first was that their ships were actually much more nimble and that the wind was blowing in England's direction rather than in the direction of the Spanish Armada.
God's favour was
That's
with the problem,
right.
I suppose.
Exactly.
That's how they concluded.
Exactly.
So she won. How popular did that make her?
Hugely.
Afterwards?
Hugely, and great contrast to her sister Mary, who had lost the last possession England had in France, which was Calais, and that was a great shame to have lost that. Elizabeth then managed to win a battle and, of course, went on to do things like the Americas. The state of Virginia, for example, is actually named after Elizabeth, Virgin Virginia. So England started to feel like not a failure anymore, but a triumphal maritime power. That's where that idea of the British Navy started.
This is why we say she reigned over a golden age. Is it a golden age? Oh, this is a leading question, because I know you love her to death, but is it because her or despite her?
I think it's got to be because of her. I think when you're an absolute monarch, you must, to some extent, create the atmosphere in your kingdom. The thing she often said was that the greatest thing she did for England was her longevity, was to actually be on the throne for 45 years. And indeed, her motto was Semper Idem, which is always the same. And indeed, anyone she hired had a job for life. You know, they literally died in the saddle. She never fired anybody. She was very consistent. And I think that kind of consistency is incredibly important in a leader, because it creates a security. It's like being a parent. You know, consistent parenting is the most successful parenting. Consistent ruling is the most successful ruling. She created an atmosphere where people felt safe.
I notice when she makes her speeches to England, she says, you know, I am your Virgin Queen, but I am married to my people. And she talks to the English people sometimes like a mother, but often as a lover.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost an erotic undertone to it, like, I am wedded to you, we are partners, I bring you my heart. It's this romantic language. Gee, that's interesting. What do you make of that?
I think she was a very whole person, and so she was able to use her femininity as well as her masculine, I'm not using this in the terms of gender, but is the masculine qualities that she had, her brain, her decisiveness, her strength of character, and her flirtatiousness, her sense of fun. She's flirting with Cecil and waltzing him in that excerpt you played there. She used that to the hilt. She used it with the people too. And they loved the fact that they had this magnificent queen, different from everybody else, all those boring blokes. Queens are always quintessentially more interesting than kings.
Arguable. We need another hour. Come back. Arguable. Arguable.
Because they're different.
Okay, you need to present more evidence, Ms. Cairo, to the bench, for that one. But nonetheless, this was the age of Shakespeare. Is there any evidence she attended a Shakespeare play, or maybe they even met? Do we know that Shakespeare
and Queen Bess met? I don't know if they actually met, but I do know that his players would certainly perform for the court and that kind of thing. He was part of the king's players, but he was around towards the end of her life. He's more associated with James I than he is with Elizabeth, but certainly he was writing during Elizabeth's reign, and his most productive year, 1599, was under her very late, the last couple of years of her reign.
There was a rebellion in Ireland, and she sent that idiot, the Earl of Essex, over to deal with it, who had won himself glory probably off her, I bet, rather than his. And he didn't handle it very well. There was wholesale slaughter of Catholics in the area. This is hard to square with her reputation for moderation, isn't it, Jane?
Look,
it's one of the darker patches of her rule.
She was moderate up to a point. She also wreaked vengeance on another rebellion earlier in her career where 600 people were hanged, ordinary people. Monarchs of that period had a very hierarchical view of who mattered and who didn't. And she was not really different from that. She certainly had her dark side. She was not pure as driven snow. She's exciting. She's interesting. She made mistakes. She did bad things. But by and large, the sum of what she did, given her time, was on the positive side of the ledger.
At the end of her reign, she was, what, 68, 70 or something when she
69.
Died? 69. Did she ever betray a sense of feeling like she'd been there too long, like she'd lived out her time in a way?
I think she did. I think she found it very hard when all her old friends died.
All the ministers died.
Yes, and she was replacing them with the new men. And there is no doubt that they were looking to this man in Scotland who everybody by then knew was going to take over from her. And she always said, you know, men are much more likely to look to the rising sun than the setting one. So, yes, I think there was a strong sense in Elizabeth towards the end that they're all just waiting for this silly old bat to die so that they can get a bloke back on the throne. And it's often struck me, it's not entirely coincidental, that there was a big outcry about witches under James I. And I often wonder if that wasn't an attempt to put everything back to rights. Let's not get uppity about this woman on a throne thing. We don't want that to happen anymore.
It's interesting if she would have said such a thing like that, as you were just saying, because it indicates that ability that a great leader has to stand right outside themselves, right outside, and perceive them as others perceive them. That's a great talent, I think. There's a poem she wrote.
Mm-hmm.
She was a writer, as we said, and very, very good with it too. The Duke of Anjou, which she did seem to love, even though, like you say, he was 20 years younger, pockmarked from smallpox.
Short. Very short.
Yes, but charming. And he seems to have beguiled her. And in turn, she wrote a poem when she sent him away for the last time and had finally been reconciled not to be marrying him. Could you just read that poem? Elizabeth I wrote it herself.
Yep, I love it. When I was fair and young and favour graced me, of many I was sought their mistress for to be. But I did scorn them all and answered them therefore, go, go, seek some other where, importune me no more. How many weeping eyes I made to pine with woe, how many sighing hearts I have no skill to show. Yet I the prouder grew and answered them therefore, go, 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 seek some other where, importune me no more. Then spake fair Venus' son, that proud victorious boy, and said, fine dame, since that you be so coy, I will so pluck your plumes that you shall say no more, go, 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 seek some other where, importune me no more. When he had spake those words, such charge grew in my breast, that neither night nor day since that I could take any rest. Then lo, I did repent that I had said before, Go, go, seek some otherwhere, importune me no more. It's not only a poem of regret for the Duke of Anjou. In fact, I don't really think she gave that much of a toss about him personally. It's a poem of regret for all the lost opportunities and the fact that once everyone wanted her and now she realises I'm old, no one wants me and no one ever will.
She's a big influence on you. Do you think she's an influence on feminist thought, modern feminist thought in general?
I think, perhaps unknown to many feminists, yes. I think it's because of her, and I've no proof of this, it's just my theory, it's because of her that feminism arose in the English-speaking world first, because she gave women a model of something to aspire to, that women could do it, and they could do it, run countries, and do it to universal acclaim. That model was there, and it was in English history.
And we get that from her. Fantastic to speak with you once again, Jane. I really enjoyed doing this. Elizabeth I herself. Your book's called Just a Queen. It's the sequel to Just a Girl. And it's been wonderful having you back on the program. Thank you so much, Jane.
Lovely to be here.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.